توی کوچه رقصیدن، برای ترسیدن، به وقت بوسیدن، برای خواهرم، خواهرت، خواهرامون، برای
سلام. In the name of the God of Rainbows, welcome to Woman, Life, Freedom, All In on Iran, a podcast series in which we'll go deep in conversations with experts on various aspects of the revolutionary uprising that began in Iran in September when 22-year-old Mahsa Jina Amini was killed in morality police detention. In each episode, we'll unpack an important aspect of the unfolding of this historic moment in Iran. I'm your host, Nahid Siamdous, an assistant professor of media and Middle East studies at the University of Texas at Austin. Our intention is to, quote-unquote, archive the important insights of our experts here and now, both in their capacity as professional observers, as well as humans living through these momentous times. Stay tuned.
This week, we'll be speaking with Asif Bayad, who needs no introduction when it comes to a study and discussion of social movements and revolutions across the Middle East. He is professor of sociology and Middle Eastern studies at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign and has published what by now are really classics, his 1997 Street Politics, his 2009 Life as Politics, How Ordinary Citizens Changed the Middle East, Revolution Without Revolutionaries, about the Arab Spring, and his latest Revolutionary Life, published by Harvard University Press last year. But first, let's situate ourselves in the timeline. Every week, I'll try to situate us a little bit in the timeline of the protests, of the Women, Life, Freedom protests that started in September. So the most momentous things that happened, events that happened this past week, today is February 6th, 2023. So last night, Shervin Hajipour, the producer and musician of the song Baroye, received a Grammy announced by the First Lady Jill Biden. It's the first Grammy given out under the category of social change. And Baroye is the song that soundtracks this podcast. This particular version is sung by Ifa. So it's a metal musician in Germany who actually came of age in Iran making music, but has done a cover of Baroye. There's so many different covers of Baroye at this point. The song has become truly universal, sung in all kinds of different languages and contexts all over the world. And Hajipour received a Grammy for this song, which at this point, every Iranian knows by heart. So that's the most momentous thing that's happened this past week. It's all over social media, and everybody is claiming a little victory in the revolutionary uprising that has been happening, even if small in comparison to the bigger picture. The other important thing that's happened is that Iran's most prominent reformist, Mir Hossein Mousavi, who's been under house arrest since the 2009 Green Uprising and the elections then, he has issued, at the time he was really arguing for, and reformists have been for a long time, for sticking to the constitution, arguing that things could be reformed if we only listen to the spirit and the letter of the law in Iran's existing constitution. He's issued an open letter basically saying he no longer believes that, and that he believes that a whole new system, a whole new constitution must be constructed and a referendum held in order to, compose a assembly that would lead and direct this new movement. So that's kind of a turnaround for sure among the reformists. And Khatami has in some ways also backed this, although he seems to still argue that also in a letter that has been published, he seems to believe that things could still be fixed if we only stuck to the constitution. I know some of these debates are moot for many people who have for long now surpassed any kind of reformist discourse, but it's still of note to mention here. So now let's move on to our guest interview. Uh,
Hello. Today on the Woman Life Freedom podcast, All In on Iran, we have Professor Asif Bayat. He's currently the Catherine and Bruce Bastian Professor of Global and Transnational Studies and Professor of Sociology and Middle Eastern Studies at Urbana-Champaign University of Illinois. He was previously Professor of Sociology and Middle Eastern Studies and Chair of Society and Culture of the Middle East at Leiden University in the Netherlands. Now, you've got your bachelor's in political science in 1977, so just a couple years before the revolution happened in Iran in 1979, and your PhD in social sciences from Kent University in England in 1984. You've held positions in a wide spectrum of academic institutions, from Berkeley to Columbia, Oxford to Brown. And of course, starting in 1986, you taught sociology at the American University of Cairo for 17 years.
Yes, yes.
So you had a long stretch of time that you spent in Egypt. So you're one of those rare social scientists who has clear insights into both the politics of, the sort of Iranian sphere and the Arab states. Thank you so much for joining us on this podcast, Professor Bayat.
Thank you so much, Nahid. It's a pleasure to be here.
You know, before we start this conversation, I just want to say your work has helped me think through so many of the processes that I've been looking at in my own work. And you have so many different concepts that have been so helpful throughout the years, you know, whether it's the idea of quiet encroachment, which you have in Life as Politics, How Ordinary People Change the Middle East, published by Stanford University Press in 2013, the idea that people through ordinary everyday acts can push back certain boundaries and really lead to the change in certain regulations. You know, your idea of social non-movements, which I've personally have applied to the easing of the hijab rules in Iran over the last, 20 or more years, in which people, women, not through organized movements, but through the sort of daily actions of non-movement have really pushed back and changed the restrictions on the hijab, or, you know, the combination term, the portmanteau revolutions. So I'm not sure that's a portmanteau, but the combination terms of revolutions, not a revolution, not a reform, but somewhere in the middle. And then for my own work, you're writing on anti-fundamentalism, you know, highlighting the fun in the middle and how the Islamic Republic has been fundamentally against fun has been useful for my own writing on music and culture. And of course, your work on post-Islamism, your 2013 book on post-Islamism and the different faces of Islamic activity and how some societies such as the Iranian, in many ways have moved beyond Islamism, which is so relevant to our conversations of post-revolutionary, the later period of post-revolutionary Iranian sphere, and most certainly the Woman Life Freedom Movement.
And of course, Revolution Without Revolutionaries, Making Sense of the Arab Spring in your book from 2017. So there's so much to talk about with you, and I couldn't really think of a better guest for my podcast, for my podcast series. So thank you again. I do want to take us back to, part of my aim in this podcast series is to kind of try to weave in the personal into the political a little bit, something that we don't really do much in academia. And I think that robs us of certain kinds of understanding. And I think you actually do that really well in your work because you're examining social movements from the street level up. It's really inherent in your work, I think. And so I just want to start really with, on the personal front with yourself and just ask you a little bit, what was it like as a person in your 20s, coming of age sort of in pre-revolutionary Iran, getting a bachelor's in political science, no less? What kind of world were you inhabiting as a 20-something-year-old in 1970s Iran? What did it feel like to be alive then in that period? What did it feel like to be an Iranian in that period? Yeah. Where was your mind politically?
Yeah. Thank you so much, Nahid. This is a wonderful opportunity for me not only talk about the current work, scholarship, and so on, and its relation to what's happening, in the region in Iran these days, and so on, but also how you know, one intellectual sort of landscape is formed. So this is a great opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you
for you know, having me here to talk about these issues.
Of course. Mm-hmm.
So I mean, really, my sort of trajectory, or shall I say, my status in my 20s, for instance, in Tehran, in some ways, been formed by the way in which you know, I have grown up and where I grew up. Just maybe I should kind of flash back a bit. You know,
yes,
I actually was born in a very small village, not more than 150 people in, you know, the area Shahriar, which is close to Tehran. And in a small village, we didn't have really no sort of modern amenities of, you know, running water, electricity or nothing, or no roads and so forth. So it was basically a bunch of sort of sharecroppers. And then when the land reform came, because my kind of family did not have, they were not agricultural people. They were Khoshnishin, that he was a shop owner. Consequently, we didn't have land. So we were one of those kind of waves of sort of landless agricultural people who were forced to actually, at the time we said, migrate, muhajirat mikonan, to Tehran, which we ended up in, you know, in south Tehran. And I think parts of also moving from the village was because the school went up to fourth grade. And after that, when I reached, there was no school, and I remained schoolless for about 6 months. Yeah. And my father, who only could read and write, and he was a truck driver, at night he would teach me and so forth.
Wow.
So so we kind of landed in South Tehran, and so I kind of brought that sort of baggage of being a sort of a village guy, you know, entering into a city with this old, you know, intrigues, with its own dynamics, which I really loved it. Interestingly, despite the fact that I was from a very small village, I just loved this big city energy and light and its complex dynamics. So from the very really first moments, I became really interested in cities, how they work and so forth. But also as a person of, as I said, a migrant with having an accent, you know, in Tehran and trying to fit into the kind of urban world, I was very conscious about my position, about the position of sort of marginalized people, and the, I could hear, you know, the way people were talking about Dahati or in
villagers
Egypt, they call,
or...
villagers, yes. In Egypt, they call it Fallahin. Even if these people have been living there for, say, years in the city, look at their sort of habitus, their the way in which they carry themselves and their and their way of life and so forth, put them in that category. So I was one of them. So I became in some way aware, very sensitive, really, from the sort of the moment, really, we began to live there, about kind of social issues, about the stratification, about marginalization, and yet very, very fascinated, you know, by the world in which you know, I had entered. So during the I did my, of course, high school there, interestingly, in an Islamic school, and which was very fascinating to me. So I became very religious. In fact, it was one that we were forced to pray in the school, collective prayer, Namaz Jama'at.
Wow, Asifjan, just so you were part of this wave of urbanization that happened in the 60s and 70s in Iran.
Exactly.
And then you found yourself sort of in this marginal positionality. I just want to ask you, the high school that you went to, is that the one, if I remember correctly, the one next to Hosseini Ershad? Or
No, that was later.
That was later,
when
okay.
we moved, yeah.
Okay.
When the one that went in the South Tehran was Jamia Talimat Islami. It was... basically a group of sort of school, basically constructed by, at the time, I would say, Islamists. It was that way of sort of changing the youth, what they said, and socializing them into religious upbringing and so forth in these schools. So we had collective prayer, we had alternative sort of entertainment. We were not supposed to go to see movies and so forth. Mm-hmm. So the whole thing was supposed to be spent really in the school.
Right.
And I became really very, very religious at the time. And I used to do collective prayer. I had to do Adhan, on the rooftops and so forth. But after a few years, I got really felt the... Actually, the pressure of this indoctrination, and I kind of rebelled, and I told my father, "No, I'm not going to go to the school anymore."
Okay.
And that was the time that we moved to Golhak, where my father had found a new job there. So that's the new school where I went, which was close to Hosseini Ershad. And then I went to university and so forth. In the university, then a lot of people, I found a lot of people like myself who were from sort of hinterlands, from provincial areas, villagers and so forth. And we kind of identified, we found each other in some way.
Right.
And
also, can I just give you a little pause for those who might not know the significance of Hosseini Ershad, where Ali Shariati, of course, gave his famous sort of pre-revolutionary lectures that really revolutionized a lot of especially sort of Islamist leaning people, since we mentioned Hosseini Ershad a lot. But so in university, then you found a lot of other kids like yourself who had come from the margins and
Exactly. And then so we found each other and we sort of formed somewhat kind of reading groups, and we began to be critical of what was happening. And as I said, I had been very religious, and I became very anti-religious. I became really the other side. And I began to read Darwin and historical materialism. I kind of left this sort of literature. And then I became really leftist. And then, towards the end of my studies, things began to change in Iranian society at the time. So that was kind of the late 70s or so. The first sort of sign of letter writings by intellectuals began. And the Goethe Institute formed, I don't know if you, I'm sure you have read about it, 10 days of, 10 days of, 10 nights of poetry reading. It became very political, and we just participated in it and so forth. So that was the context, really. So it was kind of, it was a time for people like us, a time of very interesting dynamism, hope. So that was a time also of oil boom and rapid sort of modernization in the cities, new consumer commodities, but at the same time, very repressive. So socially, economically, at the time, Iranian society was changing very dramatically. And certain groups, middle classes, were becoming, I would say, quite well off. Literacy was going up, and I think consumption was getting better. But politically, we felt very, very sort of repressive. I think that combination is something that I think Professor Abrahamian early on sort of highlighted, this this kind of uneven development, he says, that you had the economic development but political underdevelopment. And I think that was a correct formulation that at the time, as a young person, really I felt it.
And, you know, you just mentioned sort of you went from being more, you know, drawn into an Islamist current into going toward a leftist Chappie sort of current. And I'm just curious, was the political pull or social pull into those two directions, which would be yourself and historians have written about, the two strongest pulls, of course, the political currents that led to the revolution ultimately. Would you say they were kind of equal, or which one had the greater ideological attraction, would you say, in the 1970s of Iran?
That's a very good question. I think my own experience, I became religious, I became sort of religious, mm-hmm. not necessarily political religious. You see what I mean? Mm-hmm. So in other words, my religiosity in the school and the way in which we were sort of trained mm-hmm. were more sort of pious, somewhat mm-hmm. fundamentalist piety. Mm-hmm. But still, there wasn't much of a talk of politics. Mm-hmm. Leftism, however, was clearly, of course, political, and it has mm-hmm. a blueprint of a direction, was strategy, and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. I would say that at the time, as I have actually written about, Iran was in a situation where Islamization, in the political sense, really had begun. Mm-hmm. When that process was stopped by an Islamic revolution. Mm-hmm. In other words, political Islam, I would say, in the 1970s was not as strong as has been claimed in retrospect in post-revolution. I think largely what transpired after the revolution, it was transpired after the revolution, after the change in the state. So we, as the leftist people, mm-hmm. and also liberals and others, mm-hmm. Participated, of course, wholeheartedly in the revolution. Mm-hmm. But the outcome, of course, we never expected, this to be a religious sort of state, mm-hmm. Which then unleashed, Islamization largely from the top.
Interesting.
So, yeah, so political Islam, I would say, was not terribly strong, especially when you compare it, which I did, with what was going on later on, shall we say, in Egypt. Political Islam, just before, in the 80s and 90s was very powerful, mm-hmm. Whereas in Iran of the 1970s necessarily was not that really strong.
That's an interesting insight. And I wonder if you would then, because people and social scientists are still trying to really make sense of the 1979 revolution, right? 43 years, almost 44 That's years later, people
true.
Are still grappling with it. And every now and then you hear the formulation, that the revolution was hijacked by the Islamists because of the leadership of, a charismatic leader like Ayatollah Khomeini. And so it sounds like based on your description of 1970s Iran, that kind of formulation might not be so such an exaggeration.
Yeah, of course. I mean, one perhaps one criticism that one can level against hijacking is mm-hmm. that there was a plan that they would do it. They knew it. What they were doing, and then they implemented it. Mm-hmm, so mm-hmm. this is too simplistic. Mm-hmm. But the processes, however, the process, what happened, in some way allowed it, for those people who wanted to take the direction of a revolution, a certain direction, mm-hmm. It really happened. So mm-hmm. I think we should be, methodologically, we should be paying a good attention to, mm-hmm. The existing forces that were grappling with what they wanted and the dynamics between them. you know, both internally and international factors and so on that eventually sort of led to that outcome. You see what I mean?
Right. Of course.
But there are, of course, now, you know, stories and memoirs that people have been written. And for instance, that the constitution that had been written and drafted, that is, in Paris, and Ayatollah Khomeini apparently had signed it and had approved it, didn't have anything with respect to wala'at faqih or religious rule, nothing. And he wanted to actually place it onto the referendum. But then Mehdi Bazargan, who was a kind of liberal religious person, and he basically argued that, look, Ayatollah Khomeini, we have promised people to put that into, to ratify a, or, yeah, a constitution within a constituent assembly. So we should do that. And I read, actually, apparently Ayatollah Rafsanjani had told him that if you did that, then the clerics will change the whole thing.
Wow.
So that's very interesting. Yeah. If this is true, it's very insightful, which exactly this is really what happened when it went to Constituent Assembly, which a large number of them, they, which it wasn't actually clerics. It wasn't. It became Majlis Khobregan.
Right.
It was from the original. Consequently, and the rest is, of course, history.
Right, the expert assembly.
Right. So there were there was, of course, a tendency on the part of certain segments of the new elites to pull the revolution in sort of Islamist direction. But then we have to ask, why they were successful. How come they were successful? Why others were not successful? I think these are the questions that when we talk about revolution, we should pay attention to.
Asif John, where is this account written?
Which account?
The account that you just talked about in terms of Rafsanjani saying, if you give this to the Constituent Assembly,
There will, because there is now a discussion about what is happening and the and the new declaration that Khatami has given and so on. So there are actually, I read a couple of days ago on this. Yeah.
Interesting. So I'm just wondering, so if we're to ask the question, why were they successful in pushing this through? How could they really eliminate these competing factors so easily? Do you think in the end that perhaps, given that Islam was a part of a majority of Iranians' lives, is that a fair comment to make about everyday life and practices, that was perhaps the most trusted, religious and ideological force that people simply didn't think could do them harm? Is that a fair way to express this?
Well, partially, yes. I think the key thing is when there is a political breakthrough happens, and I think that's very relevant to today's, Iran too, that one has to think about. When the political breakthrough takes place, one has to see who are, which groups are the most capable and willing to actually take power, because that's the time of competition to exert power, to exert hegemony. Despite the coalition that is often formed before the political breakthrough, before the collapse, right? Which everything is general, vague, and so on. We want a different future and so forth. But when the political breakthrough happens, when the collapse happens, then that's the moment. See, who are the most capable? That usually they would really take over, unless prior to that, there is an agreement. There is a rational coalition that people get together and agree on what to do and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. If you don't have that, mm-hmm. and the coalition is basically imaginative, right, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Rather than real,
right.
Then the competition is pretty inevitable. Mm-hmm. It's interesting. These days, right now, mm-hmm. The competition exists before the collapse. Maybe mm-hmm. that's okay. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? There are a variety mm-hmm. of forces and so forth. Mm-hmm. Competition is inevitable and conflict is inevitable. The mm-hmm. point is when that happens, before the collapse is or after. Now, it is before, right? Whereas in the Iranian Revolution of 79, mm-hmm. it was after.
Yeah? Right, right.
But as I said, the alternative to this imaginative coalition is a deliberative coalition. Mm-hmm. That is, people actually sit down and talk mm-hmm. and say, okay, we are different, but we agree on certain things, and mm-hmm. we go up to this far. And, mm-hmm. We agree on whatever. And when the new situation arises, then, for instance, we leave it to the elections and the will of the people and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. So that could be kind of a deliberative, in some way, rational, negotiative sort of process.
That's really interesting. So I wonder, I guess the revolution perhaps was inconceivable enough in 1979 that people just didn't really organize enough about
yes.
what shall happen afterwards. Whereas now there's so much anticipation of the kind of collapse that you talk about, that there's a whole lot more conversation about what kind of coalition, what kind of groups might take over, even though without too much leadership. And of course, that's been something that's been at the center of a lot of these discussions and debates. I want to take us a little forward. And it's interesting to me because, of course, the question of whether the Woman Life Freedom movement was a revolution or an uprising or protests has also been a very heated conversation with some people, you know, being very, very upset when the word revolution isn't used, as if sort of calling it a revolution will will it into being a revolution. And if, you know, calling it protests or uprisings in some ways takes away from the power and the, the sort of transformational nature of this movement. And I realize this is, you know, not a question that it's not a popular question to ask. So I won't ask you right away how you would describe this movement, but I want to, we'll get there eventually, but I want to take us to 2009 because you have written about, you know, something like a revolution and, you know, these kinds of, pushing away back the boundaries in on a very daily kind of basis that forces the system or forces the given circumstances and conditions to adapt and bring about certain kinds of changes in the social and political lives of people.
I think the Green Movement of 2009 was largely a reaction of a kind of popular reaction to the counter-reform onslaught of the Vali Faqih faction. Mm-hmm. That is the clerical hardline, really, faction mm-hmm. that did not want to see the kind of reform that had been unleashed since 2000, the decade of 2000, by mm-hmm. the presidency of President Khatami and so on, to carry on. Mm-hmm. And they were very adamant that this would be an existential threat to the project of Vedat Fabri. Consequently, they fought against it. And, you know, part of it, I don't have time to describe, you know, what they did and so forth. But one thing which people thought that they were doing was this fraud in the elections. Mm-hmm. And they, reacted to that. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't just the perception of fraud, but the accumulation, really, of grievances, largely political grievances, that they had, these people, that basically they wanted an accountable government. It was a democracy movement. It wasn't a movement to necessarily transcend and go beyond the existing system. They wanted to make, they wanted to see the system more kind of democratized and to be more accountable. And I think today, however, it seems that that project is seen by people to not to work. That, in other words, this there is a perception that this system is not reformable. And this has been expressed also by a number of reformists themselves. Yeah, and that includes, of course, Mir Hossein Mousavi's new statement the day before yesterday. So in this sense, politically, at the political level, the current, I would say, episode, the uprising is very different from the Green Movement. Even it's very different from, you know, 2017 and 2019 sort of uprisings.
Mir Hossein Mousavi, of course, the leader of the Green Movement, who's still under house arrest and former prime minister during the Iran-Iraq War, and someone who has come around to issuing the statement that you just mentioned, that the system is not reformable. Do you think it was not, I mean, of course, there's a regime change, you know, faction that has been very strong and, you know, in the U.S., that is almost sort of ahistorical in pointing to the way in which, you know, the political situation in Iran has progressed over the last, let's say, 15 or so years. And, you know, they point to people who ever thought of reforms as being possible as having been completely sort of either naive or regime apologists. Do you think in 2009, it was still conceivable that this system could reform from within in a way in which, you know, its elected elements as opposed to its appointed elements, right? Iran being a kind of sort of, you know, dual system at that point still, I think at this point we can safely assume that it's mostly an appointed and sort of engineered system. But do you think in 2009 it was still conceivable? Were people too naive to believe? Because this is millions of Iranians coming out on the streets and asking for those reforms, right? Were they naive to believe that it was possible still then?
It's really difficult to answer this question because it didn't work, right? Now, we know that it didn't work. Now, why it didn't work? Was it because people were naive, or perhaps there were other factors involved? Let me just say that I'm not sure that necessarily it was naive, because previously, you know, prior to the Green Movement, there was a period where really the idea and ideals of reform gained incredible momentum. And I'm talking about after the elections of President Khatami. And I think some notable, I think, social and cultural openness, relatively, of course, did take place. And, you know, I used to go there very often, and I could actually observe very significant changes that happened then with the previous decade. So, and the elections that took place, and the, you know, in the parliament really changed, and parliament was very critical, you know, of the you know, policies of the non-elected bodies, and the press really became amazingly good and open, and there were a time of social movements, women's movements, the youth movements, and a lot of NGOization began, and so forth, cultural openness. So there was a lot of debate. There was a time for a very serious debate about the nature of Islamist state, and the critical voices were, you know, present in the public sphere and so on. So people could see that, you know, that elections actually matter and it gives results. So, and we can experience this result, right? Mm-hmm, and perhaps precisely for this reason that the other side was so adamant that the other side, I mean, the sort of the hardline, we say, Hakimiyat Velayi, or the Velayat Faqih side. Mm-hmm. So they felt the threat, and basically they decided that from there to stop it. So were people, you know, naive? Well, there were evidence that things could actually change. But why, you know, it didn't continue, that's the fundamental question. So in other words, in a green movement, so the kind of resistance that took place was, of course, adamantly nonviolent and kind of a mass movement and so forth. And I was thinking at the time, later on, sort of try to compare it with what happened in the Arab Spring of 2011. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult for me, you know, sitting outside and then expecting certain things. It is not necessarily, very humble.
Right.
But I was thinking, is it possible for people who were on the street stay rather than go home? Mm-hmm. In fact, the security forces these days, they complain about the bravery of the new generation. Right. And in fact, they have expressed that, they don't afraid of us anymore, right? Whereas at the time, they were afraid. So, they would disperse, despite the fact that there was a sort of really a massive sort of presence of people on the street. Right. If they had resisted, would that lead to change? I don't know. It's very difficult to say. Right. But what I'm trying to say is that I wonder if there could be a different way of sort of resisting or not. Mm-hmm. And of course, against me, certain reformists would say that actually people shouldn't have done it at all. Mm-hmm. Because that made the regime more aggressive and to push for its sort of claims, mm-hmm. and further take the society further towards kind of a Islamist way of governing.
Right. It seems to me, in 2009, that it really was a key moment, and it was very clear from Khamenei's speech, the first speech he gave after the elections, that he was not going to give an inch, and there was not going to be any kind of, compromise or any taking step toward anybody who thought that the elections were fraudulent. And instantly he referred back to his, very well-established, sort of thinking of Tahojjum-e Farhangi and foreign intervention and all of that. And this is something that he's continued, of course, throughout these recent protests. But it's true that, yeah.
But I was going to say also, but beyond this, in terms of, how perhaps resistance could have happened, it was also limited, right? It was largely, I would say, urban middle class sensibility and their largely presence. Although we have heard things, for instance, my own village, that people were, pro green movement and so on. But it was largely, as I said, urban in the big cities like Tehran and Tabriz and so on. But the marginalized groups and especially rural areas were not necessarily part of this process. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think that was one of the kind of key perhaps weaknesses. Mm-hmm. And the regime had, certain still, social bases. Mm-hmm. I mean, a strong social basis still has. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And which that, again, differentiates it from what is happening today, which is a national, has become a really national movement with a variety of constituencies, rural, urban, marginalized, middle classes and ethnicities and so on.
Much more widespread. I was reporting on the 2009 uprising in Iran, and I was in a lot of the protests. And personally, because of the people whom I interviewed, I like to push back a little bit against the notion that it was, mostly middle class. Okay. Because I talked to all kinds of people, like a grandma from actually Shahriar. I mean, the Shahriar, mechanic, the kinds of people you wouldn't count as being part of the middle class. But I know that, ideologically or in terms of intellectually, that's what it was. It was a movement for reform. So it was, I think, you're right and others are right, because this is something that is kind of, held to be a understood sort of notion of the Green Uprising. It certainly was in its aspiration, it was sort of a middle class movement in that it aspired for these, intellectual goals of reforms and elections and these things rather than sort of economic goals, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But I know that you have in, if we move it forward a little bit, and you already talked about the Arab Spring, I know that, you have compared actually the Woman Life Freedom Movement more to what happened during the Arab Spring. And I wonder if you could, just give us a little bit of your insight in where you see the comparisons between these two uprisings or slash revolutions.
So, the way in which, the most obvious one is the way in which it really began. They both began. And I think, the triggers. And so in Tunisia, largely it was the self-immolation of Mohamed Bouazizi that somewhat, inspired and inaugurated, the uprising there. But of course, there was a basis for it, right? Protests had happened earlier on in the provinces and so forth. But that moment was, I think, very significant. In Egypt, it was the killing of Khaled Said, the young man who was reportedly tortured really to death after his arrest. Created this incredible outrage on the part of young people and others, and that was the beginning. But again, these countries and their political economies had the had bases, there were grievances, socioeconomic and political, but they were the triggers. And in Iran, it was of course. Mahsa Amini's tragic death in custody so in some way these are comparable, and I do think also that in terms of grievances in social and economic but also political, they are all, I would say, comparable. So socioeconomically, these societies are not pretty friendly to the majority of people. And politically, they are basically autocratic. And all of them are in a similar position. But I would say that, however, in the Iranian case, there is much more social control of the life world than we had seen in the Arab world ever. I mean, it's not really comparable. Iran, perhaps, at this point is, at the point that that incident happened, was more comparable perhaps to Afghanistan under Taliban. Mm-hmm. And that's why Iranians saying Talibanization of the regime, right? That process has been happening. Mm-hmm. I think that really matters. And the kernel, in some way, of the life world, maybe in any society, are women. So I would say the colonization, in some way, of the life world has meant the colonization of women and their mode of thinking and living and their lifestyle and. As basically in denial of really citizenship, not much social rights, civil, in some ways, civil even rights. Civil rights in the sense that there was sex segregation in the parks and in the institutions, the universities, and so forth. So there are much more, I would say, social and cultural grievances in Iran than you've had in the Arab world prior to their uprisings.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And you mentioned, you know, and you had a piece out in October in New Lines magazine, A Global Iran is Born, which apparently was an interview that was published in Etamat newspaper on October 10th and then translated and published in New Lines magazine. And you mention in that piece very much sort of you point to the issue of dignity and life, which is comparable between what happened in the Arab Spring and then in the Woman, Life, Freedom movement. And which, of course, is also reflected in Shervin Hajipour's song Baraye, which last night won a Grammy for, you know, the first song ever to be given an award for social change, a song for social change. It was announced by the First Lady, Jill Biden. And, you know, in it, we really hear sort of this note that, you know, the song is obviously written from tweets by ordinary Iranians. And we really get this sense for, you know, how much this movement really is about a sense of dignity and a normal life and a respect of nature and environment and animals and human beings and sort of this, you know, basic decency toward life. And you write in your piece, and I quote, when you talk about a global Iran, that you're talking about a collective, quote, collective of people separated by geography, but very much together in feelings, in concerns, and in dreams, end quote. And I'm just wondering if you can tell us a little bit about how do you think this, you know, this notion or this sense of a global Iran, which I think we all feel and we know because of this, the huge waves of migration that have happened over the last 40 years, right?
Right.
These layers and layers of expatriate Iranians all over the world, that there is, in fact, this global sort of network or coalition of Iranians feeling what you write in your piece. And I wonder if you think that is, how is that, do you think, helping the cause of Iranians who are still living in Iran and trying to really bring about a change to their current political situation? Is it helping them? How do you see that dynamic working out?
Sure. Yes, I think prior to the Green Movement, I think we had perhaps two Iran of Iran of Iranians who live in Iran and those who lived outside. And I think there was some sort of degree of a good degree of, I would say, separation and even some kind of a suspicion that those people who left, they didn't care much about what was happening. Or they couldn't stand by the kind of troubles that others have endured, and so they left for a more comfortable life. Mm-hmm. I think this changed in some way during the Green Movement. I think there was a good degree of sort of unity and togetherness and shared feeling between the two sides, the two Iran. But I think in the current uprising, this has been, I think, pretty unprecedented in terms of the sort of identity of concerns and the dream of, a different kind of Iran that both outside and insiders really share. I mean, one reason, of course, has the number of Iranians have outside have increased, and there are millions now. But also, I think the new communication, I think, technology has helped to maintain a much closer connection. The existence of all these videos and so on, one could watch and actually feel that as if one is in the streets of Mashhad. What was happening. And there is this kind of solidifies in some way that shared feelings. And I think Iranians, outside have been pretty instrumental in their support for a kind of meaningful change in Iran. And I think Iranians inside Iran also realize it, because they also are connected much better to what is happening outside Iran than they used to be in the past.
Right.
So so the connections and a closeness have been possible on both sides, yeah. And there is some kind of appreciation, I think, in some way of both sides. And in this sense, I think, global Iran somewhat, has been generated. And a lot of, as you know, Iranians living in America, Europe, or wherever, they kind of live as if that they live and think constantly about Iran.
Yes.
Yeah. A lot of their lives seems to be even temporary, although it could be a permanent temporariness. In the sense that, they have this dream of, just going back to Iran, and they are living here temporary. But this can practically last forever. And I think this is also a situation of many, diaspora population in the grip of, certain political constraints in the home country.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I mean, how did you feel about sort of, when this recent uprising, as yourself, as an expatriate who very much thinks and works on these, developments in Iran, how did you personally feel about what was happening? And I mean, is it different from previous waves of uprisings that you've seen in post-revolutionary Iran?
It was. I was, of course, like, many others, I was totally surprised, and I didn't expect. Although I had written about, both in the context of the, Arab countries and in Iran, that the dynamics of the struggle that has been going on in the region and also in Iran, that is this continuous everyday struggle for creating new norms and practices, more liberating norms and practices in society, has been going on for now for decades. But it was predictable that at some point that at some point became really very unquiet, noisy encroachment and aggressive encroachment would lead to a turning point, because the other side, that is the adversaries, the state and power, would also react. And I think this, what happened in the case of Mahsa Amini and the sort of women wanting to have, control over their lives as human beings, as citizens. And they have been struggling for this for decades on daily basis in the workplaces, in the parks, in the buses, in the education system, and in the courthouses. And they have been, in my view, have been successful in pushing the boundaries and winning new trenches as they move forward, and teaching to their children, right? And that's key, teaching to their children. And now those children have taken the banner of their elders, and they are pushing forward. And when, the sort of politics at the top, now this is the politics at the bottom, right? Politics at the top changed. That is what in Iran they called yek navakhti, or homogeneity of all the sources, all the powers, right? Executive and parliament and presidency and judiciary and so on became one, all hardliners. Then they began to basically say, okay, that's enough, stop. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm, yeah,
and it's going too
so
far.
He's going too far. So here they are pushing, over there they are saying stop. And in fact, they want to regain. That's the thing, not just stop, regain again the life world the everyday life of people. And the result was, of course, this incredible conflict. And the role of women been quite incredible and unique, you know, in terms of not only the recognition of the dignity of women and beyond that, the dignity of human being, but also recognition of the centrality of women's question within a big uprising, recognition by men, also recognition by a lot of traditional women who actually do wear, like my mother, hijab and so forth. And that is, I think, quite unprecedented and extraordinary.
Yes. And, you know, I mean, it's been such an inspirational movement in the ways that you just described. And you've also written about this sort of social non-movement, which has been such an interesting way of thinking about things, about how women really have pushed those boundaries on a daily basis through the ways that you describe, whether it's, you know, through wearing the hijab less tightly or pushing in the courts and on the streets and in politics and elsewhere. But when we look at, you know, the region, and we just talked about the Arab Spring, of course, the outcome of the movements in the region are not at all uplifting. Right. You know, we've seen this wave of authoritarianism, the Arab winter, which you have also written about, you know, the turning around of these, you know, the really sort of depression of those movements and the strong hand of authoritarians and dictators. In the end, winning the calculations and the dynamics, and not least, even recently in Tunisia, the one example that we could hold up, you know, in the Arab world, saying Tunisia managed to transition from a dictatorship to a democratic system. Even there, Kais Saied, of course, has now instituted a constitution that is more restrictive than what existed under Ben Ali. And so I wonder, I mean, if you, and yet we don't want to compare what's happening in Iran to the to what happened in the Arab world, not only because we want to have a better outcome of it. And I'm, you know, and I'm just wondering, like, where, without asking you to sort of, you know, look into your crystal ball, but where, as, you know, as a social scientist who's studied these movements for decades and who's, you know, been, has experienced them as a human being yourself, right? In 1970s Iran and onward and the waves of protests that have happened in Iran. What is your, I don't know, what do you think, where are we heading? What's going to happen to Iran? What's going to happen to us? Where do you see this unfolding?
All I can say is that, well, it's not just all I can say, but one of the things I can say is that things are not inevitable. I mean, the dynamics of revolutions are very complex, and in the sense that the dynamics are not restricted, or the process is not restricted within a you know, national government, nation state, but rather has been influenced by a variety of happenings here and there, outside and so on. Now, the fact that, look, the fact that Arab Spring, at least at the political level in terms of democratization, you know, has failed, should, or one would expect, to lead for a different outcome elsewhere. Because the idea is that people are supposed to learn, right? Not only, of course, regimes learn, right? The adversaries learn from each other to stop change, but also people learn to push for change. So, in other words, what happened in the Arab Spring is not necessarily the outcome that perhaps, you know, Iran should experience. And if there are as I say, attention to what happened there, try to address those, I think. So that's the, I think, the most important thing I can really say. So, yes, I mean, they did lead to again, authoritarianism, and one can discuss it or why, they happened. But let me also add that while kind of as a nuance is that although at the political level, things didn't change, at a social and cultural level, a lot has changed. And I think that's key. And I've tried to address those changes at the grassroots level among people, among women, among young people, about subjectivities in terms of relations of hierarchy in the education system and so on, in farms, factories, families. And these things matter, I think. And I think significant changes happen, and I have tried to address those in my latest book, Revolutionary Life, The Everyday of the Arab Spring. You correctly brought the example of Kais Saied and what happened to in Tunisia. But over there, also, there has been incredible resistance against Kais Saied, who once was a kind of a savior. He is no longer a savior. And the indication of last elections, it was totally, it was a defeat, really, in terms of participation. It was very low, incredibly low, so that actually it is illegitimate in some way, elections. And in other words, because the societies have been transformed, and they do not necessarily buy what, certain populist leader rises up and wants to do. I think in the context of Iran, and the fact that you are asking me this question shows also the awareness that we are aware of what happened elsewhere, and it is we should be addressing, I think, the situation that we are at now. And I think a lot of people are thinking to avoid, that kind of outcome.
Mm-hmm, for sure. And, it's an unfolding story. And as it unfolds, we will be reading you closely, Asif Bayat, and, watching closely and hoping for the best and working toward the best, I suppose. And thank you so much for being on this program, for giving us your insights from the personal to the intellectual and your work, your writing. It has been really a pleasure having you and talking to you about these momentous and historical events that have been taking shape.
Thank you so much, Nahid, again, for the opportunity to reflect on some of these, I think, important issues that a lot of our fellow citizens also think about.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Professor Bayat.
Bye.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, that wraps up our interview for this week. Thank you for listening. My guest was Asif Bayat. He's the Catherine and Bruce Bastian Professor of Global and Transnational Studies and Professor of Sociology and Middle Eastern Studies at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign.
You were listening to an episode of Woman, Life, Freedom, All In on Iran, broadcast to you from the University of Texas at Austin. I'm your host, Nahid Siam Dust. Until next time, Zhinjian Azadi, Zan Zendegi Azadi.